This is the Saturday Night Live Friday speaker meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous held at Westgate West in San Jose, California on May the 4th, 2001. Our speaker is Mike R. of Boulder Creek, California. The original recording of this meeting is kept in the SNL tape library. Please observe the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not play this recording for commercial or entertainment purposes. Please do not break the anonymity of the speakers or any other AA member at the public level. Thank you.
Hi, Jim. My name is Mike, and I'm an alcoholic. And I base that self-diagnosis on the description of an alcoholic given in our big book, which was on the table there. A young man snatched it up a little while ago, and it went someplace. And in Chapter 3, it states that we're men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. That's all it says. It doesn't say who we drank with, how long we drank, what gender we were, if we were cross-gendered or engendered or any of that stuff. It just says we had a problem with control. And when I was brand new here, I really didn't have any problem with that. In fact, by the time I got here, I didn't have a problem with hardly anything. I was lucky in that I got beaten up so bad that I was just, I guess I can liken this to, some of you may remember a movie called Groundhog Day with Bill Murray. And every day he'd wake up in the same day. And I just kept waking up in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the way it was for me over those couple of years. I'll try to tell you a little bit of what it was like for me and try to keep it. It was nice to come back here and speak again. This gives me a chance to vindicate myself. The last time I spoke here was probably like 15 years ago. And I got up here and got into my talk, and I remember I stuck my watch down in front of me. And by 5 minutes to quitting time, I was just starting to get sober. I just loved my drunkalog so much. So I'll try to give you the Reader's Digest version tonight. And I was born as an only child into an Air Force family. My mother and father met in a USO at the end of, not the Great War, that's World War I, but World War II, and got married and had me. And when they had me, they were done having kids. Not that I was so terrible when I was new, but I was a little bit of trouble. I was born with a hair lip and a cleft palate, so they couldn't bottle feed me or breastfeed me, and I took a lot of extra care, and I was a crier, and I was probably a little bit of a pain in the ass to my mother, who's actually admitted that to me now later on in years. When I got here, I could blame my alcoholism on a lot of stuff, but now that I've been sober for a couple of 24 hours, I really can't blame it on much. I mean, my parents loved me. I mean, I was never abused as a child. I probably could have been abused a little bit more. I might have turned out a little better. Who knows, if I would have been whacked around a little bit. But my father was, the kind of guy who never really whooped up on me or anything like that. In fact, I remember the only time he ever got angry with me on Air Force bases, if you're caught, if you get in trouble, it's just as if your father did it. Whatever you do, your father has to go before the base or wing commander and answer for your actions, if it's big enough where it gets. One time I threw eggs. I threw eggs at a GI in a service club. And by the time I got home, the air police were out in front of our little mobile home with the red lights going around. So that was a crime. And my father had to go before the base commander, and I didn't throw eggs no more after that. It was a big deal. when I was a little younger than that, we were playing with toy soldiers and lighting them on fire with lighter fluid, and we burned down a garage. And when my father came home, you know, he saw the burnt down garage, and he says, "Where's Mike?" And Mike wasn't to be found, and he found me under the bed. And he knew that I probably had a hand in the garage fire. And he got angry with me. And his face turned all red, and he turned around, and he put his fist through both of the walls. Just, boom, that quick. And that impressed me as well. And so I wasn't too much, until I was a lot older, I didn't get in too much trouble when I was younger. But the only thing I can tell you about my youth that I remember is that traveling from place to place, you know, I guess I could, you know, if I really wanted to try to glean a little sympathy from me, I can tell you that, you know, people used to make fun of me when I was younger because I was a hair lip. And people, you know, you've heard hair lip jokes before, you know. What does the hair lip shoe salesman say, you know? "Excuse me, miss, may I look up your thighs?" And things like that. And people would make jokes, you know, and I talked strangely when I was younger because I went to speech therapy for, like, I don't know, 10 or 11 years. And now I can talk pretty good. My D's and N's and G's are a little weird every once in a while, but that's about it. In fact, I turned into a singer, which really amazed the hell out of my mother. And so, I mean, I had a little fun made of me, but everybody gets some trouble in school, you know. I wasn't very sports-minded. I was the kind of kid that if I couldn't do it right from the gate, if I wasn't good at foursquare, I didn't play foursquare. And if I wasn't good at basketball, I didn't play basketball. Needless to say, I didn't do much because I wasn't good at any of that stuff right from the gate. I wouldn't practice anything. So I was kind of an outside kid, so I got into my own little world, and my deal was I made things. You know, I would make things out of cardboard boxes and stuff like that. And I essentially lived in fantasy land. And the reason I'm telling you this is because that's where I stayed. I got in this little place in between my ears, and all you people that ever bothered me or taunted me or made fun of me were those people, and I became bigger than life. I was in between my ears. I was Super Mikey. And I would be the one little toy soldier over here with all these toy soldiers lined up over here, and I would go over there and kick serious ass on all these other toy soldiers over here between my ears. And that's how I lived until I was dumped on your doorstep here in 1982. My father retired from the Air Force in 1967. Before that, we were transferred to, in 1963, we were transferred to northern France. And the first time I can remember drinking and getting in trouble, we were in this little village called Foucaucourt. And over there, there wasn't enough room on the base for all the families to live, so somebody would have to move out for you to move into these little mobile homes they had on the Air Force base. So you would live on what they said, the economy, and you live in these little villages in France. And we lived in this little village, and a friend of mine came over and spent the night with me, and we decided to get into my parents' liquor cabinet. And we went through all this stuff, and we found this stuff called cherry herring, which is like a liqueur. It tastes kind of like cough syrup. It's pretty good, actually. We could get it down, you know. So we found that one, we liked that one, and we drank it. And we got silly, and we got curious, and we got wild. So we started going through the house, and we started rummaging through my parents' bedroom, and we got into my mother's underwear drawer, and we found these leopard skin bikini underwear. And somehow, it was a good idea for me to talk my friend into posing on my mother's bed with these leopard skin bikini underwear like he was Tarzan. And I took a picture of him. And being the little jokester that I was, I thought it would be cute to send a photo, a copy of that photo to his girlfriend. And I did. And nothing was said about it. And it was right before Christmas time. And this, by this time, I had moved on base. And he came over to my mobile home and knocked on the door, and he said, "Come on, let's go to the teen club." Because that's what you did when you were on base. You went to the snack bar, the teen club, and the movie house, and the bowling alley. Those were where the kids hung out. And let's go to the teen club. So as soon as we cleared the corner around my mobile home, he turned around and, boom, gave me one right across my lips. And I remember being back on my elbows, both nostrils bleeding, looking up at him and go, what was that for? He goes, that was for sending that picture to Linda Moeller. And that was the first time I remember getting drunk. And my life kind of went along that way every time I got drunk until I was dumped on your little doorstep here. I was always getting my nose bloodied, but I always went back for more. So, that was northern France. Charlie de Gaulle kicked us all out in 1965. I went to England. During this time, my father was the manager of the Airmen's Club, and that's where all the airmen went to go get drunk and party down with the French girls that they would bus in from the economy. And nowadays, that would probably be a big stink, but back then, it was the way everybody did things. But these English bands would come through from England and travel through all the European theater, that's what they called it, and play all these airmen's clubs all through the different places. My father was the manager, and he would let me go and watch these guys rehearse. And I wanted to be like them. I wanted to be a rock and roll star. And I would bug these guys to teach me some chords on the guitar, which they did. They took me under their wing. Plus, my father used to feed them when their paychecks wouldn't come in. And we also used to have these English bands over for breakfast and what have you. And they befriended me and yada, yada, yada. I learned three chords on the guitar. And that's the only thing I ever practiced in my life. I learned those three chords, and that was it. I was gone. All of a sudden, I was popular. You know, girls paid attention to me. I was playing the school dances. I knew three chords on the guitar, and I went off to England, and we went to, back then, it was like 65, and we were actually reasonably trustworthy. We would go to London for weekends and stay at this little American service hotel, just us kids, and go out to these nightclubs and watch all these bands, and then go back home. Now, I started reading in the papers how these kids... these rock and roll guys were doing a lot of narcotics and stuff like that, getting busted for pot and things like that. And I was trying to learn how to drink. I just wasn't a very good drinker. I was a puker. I had a control problem way back then, too. I would, you know, start getting a little buzz on, and I just couldn't rest in my laurels and be cool about the buzz on. I'd think, well, this is good. Just think if I had a little bit more. And I was trying to drink warm beer in England, and they called it bitter, and it was bitter. And I would take what they call a crisp in one hand, which is a potato chip, and I would take a bite of that potato chip and a slug of that bitter, and I had this little program down where I could drink pretty good. And then we started going to London trying to figure out how to get drugs. And they see us coming a mile away, and they'd sell us a bag full of oregano, and I was never able to really successfully get loaded in England. But I was drinking the whole time. We moved back to Southern California in 1967. And I'm going to give you the short version of this. But this was the first time I'd ever been to a big high school. This was a big American high school. I had gone to high schools in like Quonset huts and abandoned barracks and small little places with a bunch of kids where I could just kind of cute my way through, you know? And I had managed so far. Now I was a senior, and I was in this American high school with thousands of students in Riverside, California. And they wanted to know if I wanted the college prep course here and the such and such as this course. I got to take these classes and those classes. And hell, we just went to one room and stayed there all my life. And I didn't know how to act. And almost everybody had their cliques already established by this time. They'd all gone to school there most of their lives. And I was just a new kid in town. And it wasn't the usual for me. You know, it wasn't another Air Force base. I didn't know how to act. So I wasn't making friends quick. And I remember when I was taking my shortcut through this field, there was these kids way off in the corner of the football field that were sitting around in a circle. And they had like these fringe jackets on and headbands around their heads and stuff like that. And I'd eyeball them every day when I'd go home, you know, for lunch and then after school. And then one day, one of the kids turned around and saw me and waved me over. And I got to tell you, I'm a poster child for marijuana leads to heroin, because in 1967, I had not really did much drugs or anything like that, or even knew what the hell they were. But by 1969, I had 3 grand jury indictments and was doing a year's continuous in the youth authority. I remember when they drove me through the gates of California Institution for Men, and I'm looking up at these gun towers with these guys with Winchesters, and I'm chained around the waist, and I'm chained around the ankles, and I'm thinking to myself, I'm just a little service brat. You know, I just smoked a little dope. Maybe a shy little dope, but I mean, all I did is steal from other dope fiends. I mean, what the hell am I doing here? I just couldn't figure out what my problem was. I mean, I really felt, you know, like I couldn't believe it was me. I just couldn't believe it was me. And there was tears, you know. Step out. Wham, bam, the doors are closed. And I'm going, I have a youth authority number. I'm supposed to be with the kids, you know. And by this time, I was 18. When you're 18, you got a tour of the adult authority institutions in this state back then. And you got to go to California Institution for Men. You got to go to DVI out here at Tracy. And you got to see all the other guys in the main line and say, come on over here, man. Come on over here. Be my Ruka. And, it was really exciting. So, lucky for me, I played a little guitar and ran my mouth really good. And I just kind of cuted my way through the youth authority. I got out, and all my old druggy buddies were either gone, dead, or institutionalized. The ones that were left were doing the legal stuff. So here I was, a parolee, and I tried college, but I discovered that I could get up at 2:00 in the afternoon and go get high with my friends instead of having to get up at 8:00 in the morning. So that didn't work out. And I had to work, and one night I went out with a couple of guys and drank a bunch of tequila and woke up the next morning with dried barf all over me, and I'd missed my, you know, and this was like the third time I missed that gig, and I was fired, and I just told my buddy, you know, I said, we gotta get out of here. And he goes, why we? I said, because you have to drive my car. Now, you have to realize, you know, I was 21 years old right now, but my father had given me a little Datsun truck that was a standard transmission. I couldn't drive a standard transmission. So he had to go with me. So him and I went driving out of Riverside with me tearing up my license, and I was on an Odyssey, which eventually led me to you. I went up to Arcata, California, and put an end to a friend of mine's college education. He had a little house up there, and we showed up at his place and lived up there for a year. And just for an example of how we were living, we were up there probably, I stayed there for about 6 months. I remember about six months we were into this thing where we had run out of salt and we run out of ketchup, but our landlord kept throwing big bags of potatoes in our front door because he had a garden back there. There was an old Swiss guy, Rocco Pernini. He looked like he was 105. And he would bring these potatoes and shove them in our front door. And we eat potatoes. And we had butter and salt and ketchup for a little while. But then we ran out of all that. And we were just eating potatoes. And not once did it ever come up in the conversation that one of us might go get a job. Not once. And I got into the stealing steaks thing, you know. I was really a great steak stealer. You know, white pants, throw a bunch of steaks down your front of your deal, walk up to the front counter, you know, and the lady's staring at me like this, like, what's the matter with you, lady? You know, I'm buying my little can of peas or whatever it was for 26 cents. And I'd walk out, and my buddy would say, oh, Jesus, Renwick, look at you. And I'm bloody from here to there. And there was a couple of girls that we would see on the way to that Safeway where we stole those steaks. And they lived in a duplex, and there was like some sliding glass doors. And it was their kitchen. And they'd have like these college girl house coats on, and, you know, with their hairs in curlers and stuff like that. And they'd be cooking stuff, and they'd be running around. And I'd say, I got to get in there. And strangely enough, I met a guy who knew one of the girls. And he introduced me to one of the girls, and one thing led to another, and she let me sleep over once, and I never left. Her father was dead, thank God for him, and me probably, and her mother lived in Los Altos, So she was upper crusty, had a little dough, that kind of thing, you know. So I was not going anywhere. I had arrived. And that was a whirlwind of romance, lasted for about a year. And then I was divorced and on the road doing what I do. And, you know, in my business, in the bar business, you can drink on the job. So I did. And my deal was, like, I discovered that you could avoid hangovers by having an Irish coffee. And I used to have what they call, they know how to make them all up and down the great state of California, an Uncle Mike Irish coffee. An Uncle Mike Irish coffee is that much Irish booze, a little splash of coffee, and some half and half. Now, when you put the half and half in there, it's so much Irish booze in there, it doesn't really sit or float around. It curdles in the little chunks, and it looks like kind of like egg drop soup. And I would, you know, drink these Uncle Mike Irish coffees in the morning, and that would get me going, and I would go through the day until about 2 or 3 in the afternoon when I would pass out, wake up in time to go to work, and start it all over again. And I lived that way up until about 1978, when I started becoming a little bit hard to get along with, and some of these operations I lived in were not happy with me anymore, and I started losing time from work, and I started being, you know, I was really good at just being able to pull it off, you know. I could get on stage and shake my little ass and do the thing I did and get my paycheck but then I had this little Jewish mother keyboard player who would take care of me, and he would write all the checks for me. He would pay all my little coke debts for me and pay off all the people that were, you know, looking for me, and just took care of me for a long, long time. In 1977, right before I really fell from grace, when I was right at the top of the mountain ready to ski down, I met this little long blonde-haired girl that worked at a record store. She was 22 years old, and she was just cute as she wanted to be. And she wasn't really that thrilled with me, which made it a challenge. So I took the challenge, and I chased her around, you know, and I told her she wants to see me, and I play in a band, and she wants to come see my band, and, you know, I'm so nice, they named me twice, and all this crap, you know, talking out the side of my neck. And she moved to another record store, and I found her there, too. And I kept telling her I was working around here. I said, I'm working in this club, you know, in Campbell, blah, blah, blah. And this one club I was working at in Campbell, there was a downstairs area, and then there was like a mezzanine thing that came around, and the crowd could stand up there and watch down on the stage. And I was playing one night, and I looked up, and there she was in the crowd. And I went, ha, gotcha. And that was the beginning of my poor wife's entrance into her Al-Anon story. Because I was right at the top of the hill. I had my skis on and my poles up. And man, right when we met, I jumped off the top and I was on my way down. And it wasn't pretty after that. I mean, I had hurt some people and I had done some things I wasn't proud of before that, but now the crap hit the fan, and how can I make this quick? You know, it's just, if you're an alcoholic like me, your meat can only take so much. And my meat took it for a long, long time. And then it was, you know, the old vomit and the red blood and pooping out the black blood. And, you know, then the alcoholic seizures came down the road, and that's all I was doing. I was no longer a hip, slick, and cool rock and roll guy wearing Kiana shirts and Angel Flight pants and great big stacked up shoes. I was wearing poopy Angel Flight pants and stanky Kiana shirts and walking around in sandals in apartment swimming pools bumming spare change so I could get $1.19 so I could get a half pint of white booze, preferably hot, out of the bushes where I hid it the night before. Hot vodka was now my drug of choice. And, you know, I really relate to anybody that has vomited hot vodka through their nose is my kind of drinking. You know, because holding that stuff down in the morning, squeezing my butt cheeks together, trying not to have any little accidents, And that was the you know, my life was simple. I kept it simple. I remember there was three brothers that I knew because I lived in this apartment for a while. Once again, you know, just like that poor girl that let me into her place up there in Arcata, all my girlfriends I got this way. You know, they lived in a warm place. I was out in the cold. They let me in one night. It was like that. It was an old song, "Let Me In, Tender Woman," cried the snake. And as soon as she let me in the door, there was, you know, you had to extract me. And that was her apartment, and I moved in, and her roommate finally moved out, and I stayed. You know, that's just the way it went. And these three brothers that lived up there, I knew these guys, and they go, "Oh, look!" They told me a story after I sobered up. They'd see me rummaging around through the bushes looking for my booze, because by this time my wife was hip to me, and I couldn't get. She wasn't my wife yet; she was my girlfriend, and or whatever you want to call it. I don't know what you call that kind of relationship. But they'd watch me fumbling through the bushes looking around for that half pint from the night before. Always amazed my wife that I never bought anything bigger than a half pint. It was always half pints. Even if I had more money, I never bought a quart, never bought a half gallon. It was half pints. I had some kind of a plan. It was, I don't know if it was like genetically instilled in me from years, from alcoholics gone before me, but I never really thought about it. It was always half pints. So, after doing the detox and recovery house shuffle up and down the great state of California, I was in my last drunk farm called Lost Heads Ranch in Desert Hot Springs, very aptly entitled for me. It's still there today. At that time, it was one place I couldn't escape from. My mother had found me. Kate sent me home to my mother at age 32. She got me docile enough. She bought me a half pint of vodka. Drank that baby down, put me on an airplane, sent me home. My mother said, bye-bye, and that was hopefully the end of me as far as she was concerned. And I got down there to my mother's place, and we found a place for me out in East Los Angeles where I could escape, and I did. The second place we found was Lost Heads Ranch in Desert Hot Springs, which was right at the beginning of September in the desert, right at the end of August. Lost Heads Ranch was a mile and a half from Desert Hot Springs. So it was a mile and a half, of 115-degree desert, scorpions, tarantulas, and rattlesnakes between me and the booze. I couldn't get there. I was too sick. If I coulda, I woulda. So I managed to get about 60 days under my belt until me shot me out for my first job. I worked down at the restaurant. As a dishwasher, one of the busboys was out in the back smoking a little dope. He says, "Hey, want a hit?" "Sure, want a hit?" Started smoking a little dope. Wasn't going to drink. Drinking was a problem. Went for my second job, which was doing what I do, and went to a Mexican restaurant on a referral from a guy. And I said, "So-and-so sent me." He says, "Oh, that's great to meet you. We'll hire you. You know, so-and-so's got, you know, got good rep. Any friend of his, a friend of mine, you got the job. What do you have to drink?" I said, "Scotch neat." I'm a high roller again. So I had a little glass full of scotch. And for about 2 or 3 weeks, the couple of nights a week I worked there, I was a controlled drinker. I'd have two scotches, two Clorets, back to Lost Heads Ranch. Now I was an alky with a plan. What's going to happen was when I get back to Kate, I'm not going to be able to drink like this. But in the meantime, I can have these couple of scotches, and then we'll figure out what we're going to do later. Later. So they booted me out of Lost Heads. It was kind of okay. I got back up here, and my wife says, "Well, you're going to go to AA meetings or not?" I said, "Okay." I didn't want to get thrown out of the house again. Anything to keep the heat off me. So I called Alcoholics Anonymous and I said, "Excuse me, where do the musicians go to meetings?" If I had a little bit more balls, I'd have said, "Where do the really hip people go to meetings?" And this lady at Central Office had a lot of patience with me, and she said, "Well, we have a nice beginners meeting at Sunday night, 400 West Campbell." And I went over there, and it was a huge, big meeting. And, I don't know, there was 250 people there. And I went, whoa, this is really something. And one thing led to another, and they said, oh, come over and meet us at this meeting down the street here. It's at Condy College, the old Campbell High School. It's called Saturday Night Live. We really make it happen over there. We got a wild group. So I went over there, and everybody was clapping, and they're giving away 24-hour, and they're stomping their feet, and they're hooting and hollering, and they're booing Bayard, and just, there was a big party going on. By the way, I have to mention Jim, because I have to mention Jim. Jim invited me to dinner the night before the meeting. Billy, who asked me to speak here tonight, didn't invite me to dinner. Laurie C., who put Billy up to asking me to speak here tonight, didn't invite me to dinner. But Jim invited me to dinner. He's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm really grateful for that. God bless you. Jim has been very instrumental in my sobriety. And if nothing else, he gives us something to talk about when he's not around. And I hope he talks about me when I'm not around. I figure any publicity is good publicity. So I got here to you guys, and twice I drank again. Once my wife discovered I was drinking, she threw me out, and I weaseled my way back in again. Silly, silly girl. And we went on a little trip up to Tahoe with her family. Now, I knew that in Lake Tahoe, you just stand around. Somebody's going to come up and ask you if you want a cocktail. So I had to have a plan. Once again, I'm an outfit with a plan. And I went down and saw my little hippie guy at the end of my apartment complex, and I got this little pin roll of some kind of Humboldt purple hair, make your knees freeze and your knuckles chuckle kind of herb there, right? So I'll just take this once again, because drinking's my problem. So I took this little ping roll of pot up there to Tahoe, and I took a few hits in the crapper, you know, and got a little buzz on going on. When somebody come by, cocktails, cocktails. I'm not doing any cocktails. I'm fine. I'm cool. I'm handling it. Got it by the huevos. And we came back from that little, what was it, like a three-day weekend. And we had separate cars for some reason, a job thing. And my car at that time was a 63 four-door Impala that my wife had bought for me for $300 from one of the waitresses where she worked. And I had gotten her into the bar business. You know, once I discovered, you know, that she's working for minimum wage in these record stores, I said, let me take you away from all this, baby. I'll get you a real job, you know. Taught her how to cocktail and make that real money. And she was working at a food place and got me a car and was taking care of me. And that little car drove right down the street, and I'm on my way home, and it pulled into a liquor store. And I got that half pint of vodka, and I chugged that baby down, and I went home, and I stared up at that ceiling. You've seen ceilings like this before. It's those spackle ones, those white apartment spackly ceilings with the little shiny shit in them. You know what I mean? The little sparkles. And I looked at that ceiling, you know, with the light coming through the window. And I stared at that ceiling, and my stomach hurt, and I wasn't high, and I felt bad. One more time. I just felt bad. And I wasn't an alky with a plan anymore. I had no more plan. I mean, I went out with a whimper, not a bang. I mean, I got stories that, you know, like you have stories. The hair curling variety. You know, jumping flaming out of windows and stuff like that. You know, creating diversion by setting somebody's plastic curtains on fire and all the plastic melting on me. I could go on and on and on and on and on about stuff, you know, stuff. Guns, you know, early on, just the whole banana, you know, whatever you've lived, you know, we know what we're talking about here. But this time, just that little half pint of vodka brought me into this meeting over at the Condy College. I sat in the back of the room, just one half pint of vodka, And I guess I didn't look that good that day because a bunch of guys got up and came back and stood around me. And they said, "How you doing?" And instead of looking up and saying, "Fine," I looked up. And, you know, it was like one of those commercials, you know, where the in-laws came over where they got those fisheye lenses where everybody's face is kind of long and looks really weird. And they're all standing over me. And I just went, and snot flew out of my nose and I started crying. And I just made a complete idiot out of myself, thank God. Because I couldn't hold my mug no more. The mug holding days were over. Didn't have a plan, wasn't cute, wasn't slick, wasn't lying, wasn't doing anything. And all I can tell you is that was the surrender that saved my ass. You know, I think back, you know, what really happened then? You know, what really happened? All I can tell you is I walked in here and cried. Had I cried before? Oh, man, I could cry the good cries. I remember trying to read it for, when at the end of my drinking, the only people that had me were the people I hated, was my born-again Christian friends. They would take me in, you know, because they were good folks, right? And they'd let me shake it out in their couch while their kids would walk by on the way to school and stuff like that. And one of these ladies would give me their Bible. And I can remember trying to read this Bible with one eye, drunk as a skunk, just crying until I wrinkled about that much into the pages of that Bible, you know. So I could really cry. And I could say I'm sorry. And I could put on the show of shows. But this time around, it was just a for real thing, you know. It was as close as I ever got to that. Now, thank God for God. Because I didn't know much about God when I got here. But I do know something held me in the palm of his hands until I started taking steps. Because just like every other time, as soon as I got physically well, I started looking around here and saying, man, these people really are awfully clicky. Look at them people over there, snobby. Look at them people over there. They ain't going to stay sober. Look at them people over there. They're not paying any attention to me. Jerk-offs. You know, just the same old thing that always happened as soon as I got physically well. When I was sick, I was teachable. But it doesn't take me long to bounce back, and I started getting physically well again. But this time around, there was a podium up here that people kept talking to me all the time, and every day I was hearing people say, my sponsor says, and I'm on, you know, and I'm having a hell of a time with step three, and I'm having a blah, blah, blah with step four, and so-and-so, blah, 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 and they're talking about steps of sponsors, steps of sponsors, steps of sponsors. So I always wanted to be in the in crowd. I always wanted to be cool, and I always wanted to be hip, and it seemed to me, in my little sick brain, that the hip people at Saturday Night Live were getting sponsors and working steps. So I picked this guy out named Dan. Dan's nickname was Bear. Bear was big. Bear wore leather. Bear was going to handle Clint Eastwood here. Could never get hold of Bear. I would call Bear. This is right at the beginning of, this is how far it is to go. Right when they first started having answering machines. And I would get Bear's answering machine, and I would get mad. So I was up in the front of the meeting one time, bitching to Tim Simkovich, who I don't think is alive today, saying, I can't get hold of my sponsor. Bad, 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 bad. I get his goddamn machine, you know, it was just driving me crazy. And he said, well, why don't you go ask that guy to be your sponsor? And he pointed at a guy that I wouldn't have asked in a million years. It was not my plan. But after the meeting, I waited till the crowd cleared around the guy. And I walked up and I said, hi, my name's Mike. I'm kind of new. He says, oh, do you have a sponsor yet? I said, no, that's kind of why I'm here. Can't get hold of my other one. So this guy had kind of like a production line thing going at his house. You make an appointment with him, and you showed up over at his house, and you knocked on the front door at your time, and you waited in the foyer. Either his son or his wife would let you in, and there was a room out in the back. That guy would come out. You'd nod to that guy, go back in the back, sit in the chair, spend your hour or however long you had, and talk about steps. And... That was 18 and a half years ago. Now, I am one weak-willed, low-life, bottomless son of a bitch left to my own devices. That part of me percolates to the surface every time I start thinking about me. When something is important to me, I mean important to me, and I'm not getting what I think I should be getting, or I'm worried about you taking away something I got, all I want to do is lie, cheat, and steal and get my way. Because if I get my way, the world would be a better place for all of us. Trust me. The only way I've discovered to get out of that situation is to do something that I don't like to do. Dave N. came to me when I was a couple of months sober and said, come on, we're going on a 12-step call. I said, 12-step call? First of all, I looked at the guy. He was like 15 years old. I'm 32. He ain't taking me anywhere. He goes, come on, your sponsor's going. Oh, okay. So we got in the car, picked up this wino, took him out to Laguna Seca, and all the way there, I'm sitting in the front seat. I got my head turned around. I'm telling him all about AA. It's a great place. I'm selling it. I'm selling it just like I used to sell dope. And he's nodding. He's sick. And we get him out to Laguna Seca. I called the next day up to Laguna Seca to see how my boy's doing, and he left in the night. I was pissed. I wanted to drive around San Jose and find that son of a bitch. But that got me hooked. And then I got on the diverter when they first had the diverter going on around here. And I worked, you know, I had never worked what as musicians call a straight job in my life longer than about 2 months. You know, my parents took care of me up until I was 17 and ran away from home, where I just hustled my way into, you know, until I was out of the youth authority. When my little Jewish keyboard player, God bless him, took care of me and made sure I got doled out just enough money so I could eat. I remember one week up in Chico, California, we played for a week and we did New Year's at the end of that. We got paid triple time for New Year's and we were making great money. We were a trio working in the days when everybody had like 7 and 8 piece bands. So I was making a crap load of money. And every night after work, I would take like a couple of pitchers of screwdrivers up to my room and party with the locals. And I was the man. We had a big night. Well, unbeknownst to me, when I was getting those pitchers of drinks, they were charging me for every drink that was in that pitcher. So at the end of the week, I owed the band $1.79 when I probably made, I don't know, $1,200 back then. That was real money in the early 70s. So that's how my life went, you know, up to now. I didn't know how to manage money. I never held down a job. I never had a checkbook with my name on it that anybody would let me have. My first wife had a checkbook with my name on it, but I never saw it. I never wrote anything in them checkbook or had it in my possession ever. And on the band that I was in, the one that was my little almost had arrived band, my name was on that too, but I never got to hold one of those in my hand unless it was written to me. And now I came to you guys and I said, I have all this debt. I owe all these people. When you have a bunch of alcoholic seizures, you know, you wind up with ambulance bills and you have hospital bills. And those things are expensive. Back then it was, you know, it was thousands of dollars, which I just could never see the end. There was no way I was going to pay this off. And somebody took me off to the side and said, Renwick, send them $5. If they accept that $5, you're on a payment program. Send them $5 a week. Send them $5 a month. Get started. So that's how I learned how to pay my bills. And I said, what? I don't want to go back and work in bars again. I think it's a, you know, slippery place for me. I'll get bored. I'll get drunk. And they said, go to Manpower. I said, I ain't going to Manpower. And I'd wind up drunk. So this last time I came in, I went, okay, I'll go to Manpower. Now, Manpower didn't hire me right away. And I thought I was at least middle management material. They made me call them like 4 or 5 days in a row before they put me out in some job I didn't know human beings did. It was way beneath my dignity, I'm here to tell you folks. I took my little $300 drunk car out there and found some kind of production deal where they canned up hot soap. Well, at least it was hot when it came out of the machine. And I was expected to take these 6 cans of hot soap and put them in a box and move them down to the next person that did something else to it. And I can remember, that's how I learned how to pray. I would go into the slimy bathrooms that they have in those kind of places. You know, the men's room's got all kinds of black crap in between the grout and the tile, you know, and there's snot and everything on the window and stuff, on the mirror and stuff like that, from people flopping it out there at you, you know. And it was funky in there, but I would get on my knees in those crappers, and I would shake my fist at God, and I'd say, if you want me to be sober, you better get me through the rest of the day here, or I'm getting drunk at you and everybody else in this goddamn forsaken world. Screw you. And I can remember at the end of the night, showering all the crap off me with this incredible feeling of accomplishment that I hadn't felt in years. I felt so good because I had gotten through that job. I felt so good that it was a temporary job and I didn't have to go back the next day. And then I wound up at Memorex on the tape line there, and I did this job for almost a year, praying the same way, paying off my government assistance that they gave me. I had to pay off my welfare, because I was rigorously honest right now. I got bitten by the AA Holy Ghost. You know, I was into it by now. Call it a pink cloud, call it what you want. I was jazzed. I was digging it. I was Joe 12 stepper. I was just a happy, happy little member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I stomped my feet and clapped my hands when people came down to get their 24-hour desire chip and all that kind of stuff. And I was a flag waver. And at the end of that year, those people at Memorex said, "Well, you know, you're going on to another job." I had gotten a job in another industry, and if you ever want a job here again, we'd be delighted to have you. Now that might not mean crap to you people, and you don't know me, you didn't grow up with me, and I don't know your history or anything like that, but that's the first time in my life anybody ever asked me back to any institution other than the jailhouse, and they didn't want me there either. So it was a big deal. And I've been working at the same job now for 17 and a half years. I have chased money, property, and prestige trying to fix myself. When I first got here to Saturday Night Live and got well and started working steps, cleaned myself up and settled in a little bit, I thought to myself, you know, Kate's a nice girl. But I got so much to offer that I might have to just spread myself around here a little bit with some of these other cute little alkettes that I see strolling around. And I thought that was the way I needed to go. And thank God some people straightened me out because, you know, you always hear, she's the best thing that ever happened to you. And that's almost like, I don't know. Kate was like my mom when I finally got sober. She was the authority figure in my life. She had thrown out my shitty jeans. And I mean my shitty jeans. Because I could not hold my butt cheeks together going up those stairs coming back from the liquor store anymore. It just wasn't happening. So she had seen me in the worst. She had walked in on me one morning. This was the one. I'll tell you this story. This is a good embarrassing tale. This was the one that was on the top of my list on my fifth step because I thought it was the worst thing that I did. Because it was the one that wounded my pride the most, I thought. She walked into, I had this pool house and this really nice home this nightclub owner owned, and it was like the last place somebody actually let me live before they didn't want to let me live anywhere anymore. And walked in with me, and I saw this look on her face. I went, "What the hell's wrong?" And I looked over, and there was somebody next to me. I thought, "Oh my God, caught." But I was really caught because it wasn't another woman. It was Monty Rock the Third. Some flaming guy, kind of like Rip Torn or Rip Taylor, that used to be on Johnny Carson, that would throw stuff around and stuff like that and act up and do all these things. And I had been the night before at this nightclub I worked at, and Monty Rock had performed there. And the last thing I remember is there was a half gallon of Justerini and Brooks scotch on the bar and a great big pile of cocaine on the mirror. And that was the last thing I remember. That morning, Kate walks in, and there's Monty Rock III with his little red pantied butt sticking up right next to Uncle Mikey here. I always thought of myself, I always wanted to be the strong, silent type, kind of like Clint Eastwood. I kind of turned out to be the loud, cowardly type, but this was not in the plan, folks. The guy that owned the nightclub, everybody knew about this. The word was out on me all over San Jose. Hey, Renwick, it's happening. They wouldn't say nothing. They just look at me. And that's all they had to do. Incomprehensible demoralization everywhere I turned. Did that stop me? Hell no. I drank for about another year or two after that, just to try to make those feelings go away. It's always that way with me. Even in sobriety, when I do something that gets me in trouble, I want to keep doing more until I stop feeling that way. There is something wrong with logistics in my noodle. I don't know what it is. So I got a couple more minutes here to talk, and I'm just going to tell you that Alcoholics Anonymous has brought me things and places I never thought I'd ever be. You have turned me into a citizen. I have a checkbook now. I know how to balance my checkbook. I am a citizen. I am a home owner. I am a watch wearer. I am an underwear haver. And it is clean. You know what I'm saying? I am a world traveler. I am a sports doer. You know, I never was able to play ball. You know, I just couldn't do any of that stuff. I really hated that. I resented everybody that was a jock. I resented any girl that hung out with jocks. I just resented a whole bunch of stuff, and that was up in the upper echelon. But one day I was in Jamaica with a bunch of alkies. We had gone on my second trip in sobriety, and we had been out snorkeling. I fell in love with snorkeling, all the little fishies and stuff, and I can do it. I can float on top of the water, and I'm having a great time. And the guy says, you know, you guys have been great. You spent a lot of money with me. I'll teach you how to scuba dive for free. I thought, scuba dive, go deep, have the thing in your mouth. Hey, man, that's great. Next year when I come back, we'll do that. No, we'll do it right out here, you know. And there was these two Jamaican girls sitting there, and they said, no, man, you cannot drown. It's only 4 feet. Here we go with you. And they took my east, walked me out there. I went out there and learned how to scuba dive and got hooked. Now I go all over the place. I've been all over the Caribbean. I've been all over Micronesia. I'm going to Fiji in August, and I do all this wonderful stuff. But I'll tell you one thing. I'll go on that boat for a week, I'll come back here, and I'll start getting cranky. Because there won't be no AA meetings in that boat. I'll read my literature and stuff like that, but there's something about being around alcoholics. Some people can go a couple of weeks without a meeting. Some people can go a couple of months without a meeting. I don't think everybody has to do what I have to do in AA, but I do know what I have to do in AA now. If I don't stick close to you people, the color starts going out of the world, like our friend Clancy I says, you know? Everything starts looking black and white again, and just all, it's either good or bad. Most of the time it's bad. And I liken it to kind of like the handle on the crapper here. You know, you just kind of push the handle. This is what Jim Bayard hates about this meeting, all these people roaming around and stuff like that when he's going on. Thank God I don't hate that. Well, you got something in there? Well, I'm going to ramble on until my time is done. Oh, man, I know. You got to stay here. You know, I used to do that, too. I used to hold on to my corner of my chair, man. I know, I'm on the serious side.
On the serious side. Get your stuff, man. Because I do understand. Because I couldn't wait until that meeting was over when I was...
when I was a new guy around here. And I really do understand. Get your paper. Get your paper. I mean, I was jonesing, man. Even now, if somebody up where I am now in Santa Cruz, they have this deal where they say, at the end of the meeting, now it's the end of the meeting, they say, any burning desires? And somebody would say, well, yes, I have a burning desire. And they start talking after the meeting. Now the meeting is over. I got places to go. I got people to see. I got things to do. I got plans. And they're talking over to that meeting, and I'm just taking these people's inventory of the Gazoric. It's taken me 14 years since I've lived in Santa Cruz County to actually deal with AA in Santa Cruz County. I'm a slow learner. And I went to my sponsor, you know, and he wasn't any help either. I says, you know, they got this thing about burning desires. He goes, huh, I've never seen an alcoholic burst into flames in a meeting. So he co-signed my bullshit, you know. So now I'm thinking, yeah, my sponsor too says. So anywho, where was I? I was, you know, it's just life is good now. But all the good stuff that I have don't mean a ring-a-ding, ding, unless I stay close here and do what I'm supposed to do. Because see, I believe that I've been saved from the abyss. If that sounds dramatic, it's because I am a dramatic guy. I've been saved from alcoholic death. For a reason. There used to be a little piece of paper that I found around here years ago. It used to say why we were chosen. Chap lips. Old age. That's another thing that happens around here. You want to be an old timer, you don't drink, you don't die, you get some time. But your lips get chapped. You lose your hair. Put a gut on. Is good to you. If I don't work with others, others are going to be working with me. Simple as that. I don't do much. I do just enough to keep my nose above the water. I started secretarying here, and I took over the meeting. It was my meeting. I went and got Paz. I went and got Holt. I went and got all the heavy hitters. I was happening. And now I go to juvenile hall. Kids, you know, all I am is their mom for a couple of minutes, try to keep a little bit of, you know, keep them from going crazy and hitting me or something for an hour. And when somebody, you know, I have just enough character defects left. You know, I don't, you know, I've heard it said before that, I still have all the character defects I had when I came in. Well, if you did step 6 and 7, why the hell do they have it? If something ain't removed, this is a whole bunch of crap. They're lying to you. I think that there's stuff removed from me, but the ones that are left, just like the seven-step, you know, prayer says, if I may paraphrase, because I can't remember it exactly, don't have it memorized, that's why they have it written down, and that is that I have the stuff removed from me that keeps me from being a maximum service to my higher power. The stuff that's left makes me look good to you, and you come up and ask me to sponsor you. New guys say, huh, this guy's a lunatic. I'll ask him to be my sponsor. And I get to go through these steps again. You know, just time after time after time after time. I get to hear chapter 5 read time after time after time after time. I get to be reminded who and what I am. Time after time after time after time. Because the other chamberlain up north says, you know, you can't store awareness. Alcoholics have a hell of a time with that one. So I have to keep coming back to you. I have to admit my faults to my fellows. I have to give freely what I found here, and I have to join you. Just like it says in our vision for you. So I'm very happy to be sober today. I'm here to tell you, you can get and stay sober here in Saturday Night Live. You don't have to go out there if you don't have to go out there. You know, do what we do around here. Don't play with this thing unless you want to. If you're serious about your sobriety and you're going to give up a Friday night listening to my BS, then you might as well join in and do what we do here. What the heck? Can't dance, too dark to plow. So, with that, God bless. And dig you later.